Astronomy has a long and honorable history of collaboration among people of all kinds, professionals, amateurs, people in other disciplines. I'd like to speak to you tonight about one of the most successful recent examples of this. It fits well with a lot of things we've been hearing about globalization. I just recently got around to reading Thomas Friedman's well-known book about globalization in economics and society, The World is Flat, which gave me my first title for this talk, Astronomy for a Flat World. As you're all aware, the sky is very big and contains huge numbers of objects. Even if we just confine ourselves to the galaxies in our part of the universe, there are vast numbers. It's been the work of lifetimes for astronomers to try to catalog them and understand their properties and shapes and colors and content. But we've gone beyond the catalogs that people so painstakingly put together in earlier generations as technology has raced ahead and allowed us to map, to survey the universe as never before possible. In particular, there's a huge step forward taken with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Before this project, the best survey of the sky in visible light was with a set of photographic plates taken with the Palomar Schmidt telescope going back to the 1950s and filled in for the southern sky by the UK Schmidt telescope in Australia and a similar telescope at ESO in Chile. Photographic plates are messy to work with, to measure, and by the 1980s, optical astronomers were almost laughingstocks because X-ray astronomers had surveys of the whole sky. Radio astronomers had digital surveys of the whole sky. And at a meeting in the 1980s, Jim Gunn realized that the technology had reached a point that by using a large number of CCD chips and scanning technology, a large part of the sky could be mapped in only a few years with five different carefully chosen filters, much deeper than the Palomar survey, in a way which would include spectra for redshifts to measure the universe in 3D, and in a way which was much more precisely calibrated than ever been possible with photographs. This project came to fruition during the 1990s in the form of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. You can see a summary of the survey here. It used a specially made 2.5 meter telescope with an extraordinarily wide field, covered actually the area of sky you see here. Active amateurs will recognize the Big Dipper, Arcturus, the brightest star in the survey area, Leo, part of Virgo, the land of galaxies. And much of the initial goal of the Sloan survey was to survey the distribution of galaxies, to obtain redshifts for about the million brightest galaxies so that we could survey the structure, the patterns across the universe. As so often happens in astronomy, you set out on a big project and you find things which are considerably more interesting than what you set out to do. So for a lot of us, the most interesting harvest of the Sloan survey has been not so much in what it told us about the structure of the universe, but about the history and structure of galaxies. And the results I'm talking about came from a unique international public participation project, Galaxy Zoo, which began in early 2007. I'm told it began as a sketch of a data structure on a pub napkin, which I hope someone has preserved for posterity. It was originally set up by this international group of mostly young astronomers, led by Chris Lintott at Oxford. And building on earlier experience with first SETI at home, Einstein at home, and then NASA's experience with Stardust at home, where people inspected pictures of an aerogel which had captured comet and interstellar dust, they realized that there were some interesting problems in the study of galaxies, dating to galaxy history, their evolution, which could be solved by fairly straightforward eyeball classification of a lot of galaxies, not to put too fine a point on it, a million galaxies. at a level that still proves difficult for software to do reliably. SETI at home and Einstein at home wanted your CPUs. However, like the zombies in movies, Galaxy Zoo wants your brains. All the way back to the time of Edwin Hubble, we've recognized that galaxies come in different flavors. There's this familiar Hubble tuning fork diagram, which separates elliptical galaxies, lenticular or S0 systems in the middle, and the barred and ordinary spirals with degrees of bulge size and tightness of arms. It has been our great good fortune in studying galaxies that these classifications that you can make purely by eye staring even at an old-fashioned blue light photograph encapsulate so much of a galaxy's history, how much gas it has, how it's been forming stars. And one thing that was very powerful when the Galaxy Zoo team first set up the project was recognizing how much could be learned from looking at the environments, colors, properties of galaxies, even sorted into very large bins. Bins that were sufficiently distinct that an interested person could learn to do the sorting in 5 or 10 minutes with an online tutorial. So a Galaxy Zoo participant, after going through this tutorial, can sign in and we'll see a screen like this, presented with one of the Sloan galaxies, and sort this galaxy into one of the major classes you see, elliptical galaxies, spiral winding one way or the other, or edge-on, merger, a disturbed galaxy with some sort of tail, or star or other, things which, for the purposes of this project, we weren't further interested in. When Galaxy Zoo went live in July of 2007, by some amazing circumstance, it hit it big with BBC. It was one of the top stories on BBC.com. So many people signed up so fast that it physically damaged a group of servers at Johns Hopkins. To this point, something over 160,000 people have signed up as Galaxy Zoo participants. Every galaxy in the main Sloan sample has been classified by somewhere over 40 people, meaning that the project not only knows what the average classification is, but also knows how certain that classification is, how many people selected each possibility. So you can select samples for all sorts of studies which are gold-plated, where there is a strong consensus or unanimity as to what kind of galaxy you're dealing with. Among spirals, they included clockwise or counterclockwise, which you can think of as S-shaped or mirror S-shaped galaxies. And this could be used to test a set of studies, one of which had come out very recently, suggesting there was a curious asymmetry, that there were more spiral galaxies in our part of the universe which we saw winding in one direction than the other. And if true, that would mean there was a preferred handedness, a net spin direction in our part of the universe which you wouldn't have expected. This is an obvious thing to apply Galaxy Zoo to. And from the statistics, over and over, especially in cases where the galaxy structure is messy, it's not blindingly obvious which way the arms go, people were about 8% more likely to select anticlockwise, S-shaped, than clockwise. The team added a bias study in which participants were randomly shown the galaxy images mirror imaged or rotated, which complicated life because of the difficulty of getting the word around to everybody, but conclusively showed that the asymmetry is in the way at least this selection of people sees things rather than on the sky. So there's interesting perceptual psychology, but not interesting cosmology in that result. Galaxy mergers were a special focus. People were asked to pick them out, and they have found marvelous examples. There's some new work coming out on the merger rate of galaxies, which is based on here a much more complete and better assessed sample than ever possible before. After a while, on the discussion forum associated with Galaxy Zoo, people had been discussing favorite objects. And after somebody made this suggestion in a picture caption contest, I decided I should pass around Galaxy Zoo the memory game. And unfortunately, once you print this out from the PDF and cut it up, you no longer have the associated captions. But I think it's important to get people to appreciate galaxies. One of the things that I found a real joy from following the forum discussion on Galaxy Zoo has been hearing people, seeing them as they write, learning to appreciate the beauty of galaxies, some of them for the first time. The project has attracted people who were longtime amateur astronomers and people who never had a whole lot of previous interest in astronomy but have gotten sucked in. I got sucked in. I found out on another online discussion about Galaxy Zoo, and I started watching the discussion on the forum, noticing that a lot of the galaxy pairs people suggested might be merging looked more as if they might be galaxies physically far apart that we happened to see one in front of the other. This is a kind of galaxy system that I had been working with a decade previously, trying to study the amount of dust in galaxies, where it is, how much light it blocks, what it tells us about the galaxy's history. And in the earlier project, we had just run out of galaxy pairs to use. Looking through all the galaxy catalogs we could find, there were no more than about 20. And we had pretty much milked those for the results we could get. Six of them had been done with Hubble. So suddenly, the number was vastly increasing. By the time I started talking to the Galaxy Zoo team, there were 50 or so. And the latest number is that there are over 1,200 of these new overlapping pairs. So now we can be picky. We can divide a sample up by galaxy type, actual size, surface brightness, and find out how representative the results we have for each kind are. This project and its extension using satellite data in the ultraviolet to really study the dust properties and sizes of the grains and so forth has been compelling enough that the team has gotten two allocations of observing time on the 3.5-meter wind telescope at Kitt Peak, Arizona. Here are some color composite images from our first observing session at Wynn with Chris Lintott, Anna Manning, and me, where in several cases we can clearly see where the dust in a foreground galaxy blocks the light from the background one. Here's a preliminary analysis of one where we see the dust in two pieces of spiral arm in front of this elliptical galaxy, and we can see it in the dust extinction map. See a crude map of where and how much light is lost to this dust. Galaxy Zoo is proving to put out feelers into all areas of galaxy study. From the Sloan survey and adding the ultraviolet Galax satellite data, we've recently realized that not only are galaxies pretty much divided into spirals and ellipticals, but they come in distinctly red and blue sets, sequences with fairly similar colors. And one of the points that Galaxy Zoo has driven home in this figure from a paper which is now in press is that there are spirals and there are ellipticals, and there are red and blue galaxies. Most but not all red galaxies are elliptical. Most but not all blue galaxies are spiral. There exist distinct sets of blue elliptical galaxies and red spirals. And this can have an important impact on how we view galaxy history. And this graph shows what fraction of ellipticals are blue and what fraction of spirals are red as you go from very isolated environments far from clusters to the busy environments of galaxy clusters. Red spirals occur most often near but not right in the cores of clusters. Blue ellipticals occur most often out in the galactic boondocks. A particularly interesting result, and in a sense the signature discovery so far of Galaxy Zoo, is a bizarre object known as Honey's Forewarp, which evidence has convinced us is the first known instance of a quasar light echo. It was discovered by a Dutch elementary school teacher, Hanny van Arkel, within a month of Galaxy Zoo going online. And it all started with this post on the discussion forum, where she asks, "What's the blue stuff below? Anyone?" Among the galaxies she had been served up to classify was this spiral galaxy, which it turns out is cataloged as IC 2497, and she noticed an unusually blue, irregular cloud next to it. And she had looked at enough galaxies to know this was unusual. The astronomers on the project and in the forum started taking a closer look at this. It was very frustrating. We could see it was a lot brighter in one filter than the others. It sounded as if the spectrum had one strong emission line, but we didn't know what. I was able to get a few additional images last December with the 0.9-meter SARA telescope in Arizona, which has the advantage that it can be operated remotely, so I was actually sitting in my den with the cats doing this. Comparing that with the Sloan Sky Survey data, we were able to narrow down where this peak in the spectrum had to be. And we managed to convince some colleagues to help us out and obtain more detailed results. So this is a composite of images taken with the Isaac Newton telescope on La Palma in the Canary Islands. This is a little closer to the response of the human eye. The green of that cloud, which looks sort of like Kermit the Frog or maybe somebody holding out a basketball hoop, is the same feature that makes planetary nebulae green through a big telescope. You can see here, there's a not too odd looking spiral galaxy and all these bits of green fluff. Now, just so we get all of our identifications straight here, I want to distinguish Hanny van Arkel, Hanny's Forewarp, and IC 2497. Or, to label the conclusions we're coming to, the green cloud is a very large mass of highly ionized gas. It looks like nothing so much as the gas that we see thousands of light years from quasars or other active galaxies. It's huge. You can see here it's galaxy size. We see an extent of something like 60,000 light years. In the middle of IC 2497, we see a nucleus whose output is utterly inadequate to account for the radiation that has to be lighting this up. So this poses the puzzle we have to deal with. While some of us were at a meeting in Austin, Matt Jarvis and Dan Smith were able to get a spectrum with the 4.2-meter Herschel telescope at La Palma. Now, this is always what astrophysicists want when they face a new unknown object. The spectrum can convey an enormous amount of information. The scale of galaxies, distance, mass, chemical composition, temperature of gas, and so forth. And this broke in on us in steps, because the first thing we got right after the meeting was an emailed JPEG image of the spectrum with no commentary, so we had to work out what piece of the spectrum it was. So we could see first was at essentially the same redshift as the galaxy. It really belonged with it. It wasn't some background or foreground object. Had very strong emission lines. At the top here, the familiar green lines of doubly ionized oxygen, just like planetary nebulae. H beta is in the Orion Nebula. But then there were other things that didn't fit the pattern we would have expected from a region of star formation, a dwarf galaxy. Doubly ionized helium. Four times ionized neon, down at the bottom of the picture, producing ions that have lost that many electrons takes a lot of energy, from 3 to 6 times as much as ionizing hydrogen. There are no ordinary stars hot enough to produce these effects over anything but the smallest sublight year nebulae. I did mention this cloud was 60,000 light years long, right? To understand our excitement, I have to say a little about the arcane world of spectral analysis. This is a plot from the William Herschel telescope spectrum, where now we have, at various wavelengths, running through the visible spectrum from the violet to the deep red. And at each point, the height of the graph shows the intensity of light. Since we understand the atomic physics of how these lines are produced, we can learn what the gas is made of, its temperature, its density, and how it's lit up. As I said before, this is just like what we see in the vicinity of quasars, powerful radio galaxies, places there is an enormous central source pouring out ultraviolet and X radiation, which in turn strips the electrons off atoms and gives us the species we see here, ionized multiple times. But if we look at the center of the galaxy, we don't see such highly ionized gas. The gas in Hannes Forwerp is highly ionized, the gas in the galaxy isn't. The name Hannes Forwerp started off almost as a joke in some private messages, and it stuck, Forwerp being the Dutch for object or item. So we're commemorating the original discovery and keeping a little bit of the foreign flavor. You could call it Van Arkel's object, but that just doesn't sound as cool. So what lights up the gas? The possibilities are pretty much limited to photoionization, that is, absorption of high-energy radiation from a quasar which is now turned off, from a quasar whose view is blocked from our direction, or shocks driven by jets from a quasar. So how could we distinguish these? Well, we could go to wavelengths that don't get blocked by gas and dust, X-ray, deep infrared, and radio, and look for such a hidden quasar. This object is so scientifically compelling that we were able to get an allocation of time next year on the refurbished Hubble telescope, one of whose aims is looking in detail near the nucleus of the galaxy and seeing if we can see any clouds of gas that do see such a powerful source. We can compare it to known cases of quasar illumination. And if the quasar used to be there but essentially turned off, we can look at different places in the gas and try to map its time history. The things most like this are clouds of gas around quasars, maybe even blown out of the quasar galaxy. This is one that's been observed by Alan Stockton and colleagues with Hubble and with the 10-meter Keck telescopes. I've put the two up here to the same scale, and looking at the spectrum, it's got the same signature features we see in Hannes Forwerp, the very strong ionized helium and 4 times ionized neon lines with very similar ratios. Whatever lights up one lights up the other, and they're roughly at the same distance from the nearby galaxy nucleus. I want to put this picture up just to illustrate how strongly the gas is shining. This is Hannes Forwerp in two pictures taken from a 2.1 meter telescope at Kitt Peak with narrow filters, one of which includes H-alpha, the red emission from ionized hydrogen, and one of which doesn't. It's almost completely invisible unless you're looking on the gas emission. If you take the difference, it does bring out what looks like a second core in the galaxy. And quasars frequently turn out to have very compact galaxy companions that have plunged deep within. So that could certainly be related. One of the first intentional, purposeful follow-ups that we were able to do on this used a satellite called SWIFT, which is designed to look for gamma ray bursts. Since gamma ray bursts come from unpredictable directions at unpredictable times, SWIFT spends a lot of its mission staring at random pieces of sky, where ground-based telescopes could also see for follow-up, waiting for something to happen. And quite helpfully, the SWIFT team is willing to take suggestions on where they should be looking. So we were able to get them to spend a couple of hours looking at Hannes Forwerp with a small ultraviolet telescope on board and with an X-ray telescope. So here I'm comparing the ultraviolet image on the left with a visible light image blurred to the same image sharpness on the right. Hannes Forwerp is quite bright in the UV, so bright that putting any kind of stars in it couldn't make it that bright in the ultraviolet compared to the visible. The most likely explanation for that still seems to be that there's dust in it, which, like the dust in our atmosphere, takes any light scattering off of it and makes it much bluer. I would show you the X-ray image, but it shows nothing. The SWIFT X-ray telescope showed no evidence of a buried quasar shining through in X-rays. Just recently, we got the first new radio results. The director of the Netherlands Foundation for Radio Astronomy, Michael Garrett, read a news report about Hannes Forwerp, got in contact with the team about the possibility of doing radio observations, which, as an observatory director, he might be in a position to make happen. The first thing they were able to do was a very long baseline experiment involving a European network. And through the wonders of the 21st century, I first saw this while I was in between talks at a star party in Georgia. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. I was sitting cross-legged on the floor of a tent with my laptop and tapping into the Wi-Fi that they had run around for all the people running electronic telescopes and imagers. There is a compact radio source, so compact it must be an active galactic nucleus, but far weaker than you would associate with a powerful quasar. But we know there's hundreds of times as much radio emission. If you don't see it with these long baseline interferometers, it must be large. So we'd love to know what the rest of it looks like. It may tell us about history. So what do we think is happening here? It's related to the phenomenon of light echoes, which for a long time astronomers seem to have to rediscover about once a generation, when a bright supernova or nova went off. And looking from Earth, later on, we would see expanding rings of illuminated material as the flash of light from the explosion bounced off interstellar dust clouds, and some of it happened to reach our location. This was all worked out in detail by a French astronomer, Paul Couderc, in the late 1930s. This paper keeps popping back up when people have to rediscover this. And if you follow where dust or gas has to be bouncing light from a supernova to us and it reach us at the same time, it's along an ellipsoid. So you see here a cross-section and where the lines of sight converge. So looking from Earth, we see where this stuff happens to be in front of the object. Or if I mark up my own diagram here, we replace a supernova with a flaring or dying quasar. And Hannes Forwerp represents the parts of a gas cloud near the galaxy, whose origin we still don't know very well, where the extra light travel time taken by light making the dog leg sideways to the cloud and then to the earth lets us still see light from a source which has died off in our direct view. Maybe the best known case of a light echo was this set of Hubble images. When Star and Monoceros, for no apparent reason, flared up hundreds of times in brightness and illuminated these shells of dust around and in front of it. And each one of these pictures is a different set of slices through it. So it gives you the exciting possibility here of mapping it in 3D. The notion of light echoes from quasars gives us a new way to probe quasar history. We've probed it on the longest scales. We see the population of quasars change with cosmic time. We know that they appeared fairly rapidly in the early universe, were most numerous at about a third of the present age of the universe, and have been fading or vanishing ever since. We see quasars happen in colliding galaxies, and this tells us that they light up in episodes that are roughly the duration of a galaxy collision, 100 million years or so. We also see them flicker on times of a few years and less. But looking for these light echoes is our first chance to watch how quasars might appear and disappear on timescales of 100,000 or a million years. We'd love to know how often this happens. It's interesting, since the press reports on Hannes Forwerp came out, there have been a couple of papers showing up on the preprint archives in which people come up with plausible reasons why quasars should only be on for a million years at a time. Well, I find that interesting. There are several ways we want to try to follow this up, look for more, refine our searches of the Sloan Survey. A project I have in mind for this remotely operated 0.9-meter telescope is something I call the Dead Quasar Survey, where I've already put a new filter on it. Hannes Forwerp has helped us draw people into Galaxy Zoo. It's gotten a lot of press. Alex Zalay was giving a talk at a symposium on digital libraries, happened to mention it as part of this new way of doing the demographics of things from the Sloan Survey. It was picked up by a blogger for Science News, showed up in The Economist. For a brief period of 8 minutes, it was the top story on CNN.com. I captured that here. I made sure to capture the PDF to email to my sisters. And each of these, especially CNN.com, resulted in a new influx of people who dipped their toe in Galaxy Zoo, found the cosmic waters were fine, and are still there. So where does all this go from here? Zoo 2 has just gone into beta testing. It's a more detailed, guided classification of the brightest Sloan galaxies. We're hoping to be able to use the Pan-STARRS survey telescope for Zoo 3. This is a project which is designed to satisfy several goals at once: catalog all large asteroids, binary stars, look for extrasolar planets, survey for supernovae. And they take one of two approaches to surveying the sky, which is a modest-sized telescope, a 1.8-meter telescope with a very wide field, a Sloan-style giant array of imaging cameras, and eventually, four of these telescopes pointing in slightly different directions, so you can spend a little longer and still cover the same area of sky. And they will be generating catalogs of objects, and as they add up what's seen night after night, scanning the sky, a deeper and deeper image of the sky. And from this location on a mountaintop in Hawaii, they should have superb image quality. Looking ahead, the first work has seriously begun on the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope to go in Chile. An 8-meter telescope with a 2-degree field, a 3-gigapixel imager, which is designed to cover the entire sky visible at that location once every 3 nights. find new or moving objects instantly, within 30 seconds, reobserve them if necessary, circulate rapid alerts for objects of interest, and again, build up a super Sloan, a much deeper map of the southern sky over time as all of these looks are being added over and over. So the takeaway message, it's a big sky out there, but all together we can grok more of it. In fact, we sometimes find that having people without a particular set of patterns in their head from previous professional training may be more sensitive to finding things. So I just want to leave the URL up here, in case there's anyone here who hasn't yet gotten the bug, and take the opportunity to thank some of the many volunteers who have made the project work. Thank you.